Terry Redding has an important announcement.
So again, for those of you who just might have come in the last couple minutes, we're going to record this because it is a Napa-wide session. If you do not want your voice recorded, just let us know and I'll turn this off at the end. But this just it goes as a streaming audio on the Napa website. So it's accessible freely to anybody who wants to go. The idea is that all this great information that comes out of this is captured for posterity. So thank you. I was going to set this right there, I think.
That should be the mic.
Ideally, but no, we're just going to be very.
Okay. So, my name is Elizabeth Briety, and I am just going to be introducing each presenter. We have five presenters. It's going to be a great session, so get ready for it. And we're going to start off with Sherry Briller from Purdue, and she's going to talk to us about anthropological careers.
That's enough. I created this unwieldy title 6 months ago, Homeless Problems. I will not ignore it.
Is there a position?
I think you have to come up here and do the buttons.
Okay, I'm not usually a behind the podium person, but I can do that.
You'll be flexible.
I'll be flexible. Okay, can everybody hear me all right? Okay, let me know if things turn out differently. Well, good afternoon, everybody. The topic of this session, as you probably already know, is the relationship between university education and the world of work, something I and a lot of other people have thought about extensively. And where some of the papers in the session are going to focus directly on how well students' education aligns with particular work domains, my orientation to the topic is a little different than that. But I hope it will be complementary. It comes from my blended background. It comes from my blended background as obviously a practitioner with seniors, an anthropology educator, that is my own student up there, and she's not here right now, she has a paper here, and from being a gerontologist. So because of that blend, I'm always all about taking the long-term perspective, and that's how I approach anthropology, education, and career development as well. So my own career path, some of which you see represented up here, went like this, just for context. I was originally an undergrad anthro major, like some people who were here and those who trained. I was interested in medical anthropology and aging. I became a gerontological practitioner right here in Minneapolis. And then I returned to the academy for grad school and eventually became a professor teaching both anthropology and gerontology. So all of that informs my perspective, and I've long been interested in life course issues, how people make sense of their life experiences, both personal and professional, and how all of this, I'm getting increasingly interested with teaching and with aging myself, and how all of this results in long-term career development and what we can do as anthropology educators to kind of foster that long-term engagement among our students. So I have to say as a disclosure, I'm going to be sort of talking about my current thoughts on that and where you might come with your work all neatly tied up with a bow. That's not what you're getting today. I'm on the front end of thinking about this, so you will see some of that accordingly. Some of you may be familiar, along with Amy Goldmacher, we wrote a book that's about anthropological career development, this book that's a series of professional development exercises, and it's used by both students in anthropology programs around the country, and it's been used, I've heard back actually from a lot of career changers who've used this book as well. There's a couple of people in the audience who've done these exercises. And the reason I bring it up here is we actually have a section in our book we wrote a number of years ago called, of all things, Taking a Life Course Approach to Your Anthropological Career. So even though I teach it every single year, I revisited this section to see what I had said. Always an interesting process. And I found, just for the sake of time, I found we talk about why the life course is a powerful concept, that's all Jerry tells you all the time, why it matters for thinking about different stages of life and life transitions, and we then turn around and talk about how it relates to people's work lives specifically. And I thought what was there was, okay, I might allocate the real estate a little differently these days. The first part of our section in the book is sort of broad and conceptual and says, you should pay attention to your life course. I still believe, and that you should pay attention to the kind of social expectations about appropriate behavior and work and the messages you're receiving. And it also introduces a notion that gerontologists use called the social clock, which is about how people determine where they are in the life course, and that includes work lives, and where they think they should be. And that this is useful to know about, to pay attention to. And then, I still like it, we have a section where we basically say, feel free to ignore and deviate from this as you develop your career. So I would keep all that stuff. I think it's good. The next part of our section, just for the sake of time, is about, I would probably expand this today, is about what's actually happening in the 21st century world of work. So there we talk about changing notions of work. Some of you have been in these conversations. How the nature and timing of people's work lives are changing. Some comments about demographically growth in both nonlinear and non-traditional career paths, which is certainly true for anthropologists. Changing demographics of our field, where people end up working. Most people here, many people are from Napa, so I don't have to tell you that 9 out of 10 anthropologists end up in practice. In addition to talking about where anthropologists end up in our field and beyond, the other fields they increasingly go into, we have a small section, which is the part I would like to blow up now, which is about how to envision and re-envision your work life over time. I thought, oh, that fits off. We should do some more there. So I'm just getting around to that now. That's the topic I want to use. That's the topic I want to talk about now. And I do like this little section we have in our chapter called It All Gets Used, which is where we basically assure people that if they spend time thinking about this, almost every experience that they've had is anthropologically in their lives is relevant, can be worked into the story of their own careers and their own work life, and that all of this can be used together. We have some discussion of this phrase, it all gets used. So another piece of our original writing that I would again expand greatly going forward is we talk a little bit, but there should be a lot more done, about the value of storytelling and the value of testimonials. I really, as I go deeper into this, I think students almost can't get enough of that. And when we teach anthropological career development, that's oftentimes students' very, very favorite parts of the books, all the stories, right? This person went into this, and they, fill in the blanks career. They had a tremendous failure, but it worked out okay. It's like a fable, right? Sometimes it's like, had a tremendous failure, it was still a failure. You know, there's all kinds of variants of these stories that students hear, and I think that's very, very instructive and useful for them in thinking about their own careers. In addition, we have a whole series of exercises that we do recommend students do not just once, but repeatedly over time. And I had an interesting experience last year of a student who had used our book in her undergraduate degree and had done the exercises for the first time, and then was doing them again in our graduate program. So it was really fascinating, in that case, right there, to watch her reapproach her own writing from earlier on and think about exactly this kind of issue with a decade in between. So that was really interesting. For the sake of time, I'm just going to show these, but these are some of the kinds of questions that we offer in our writings about taking a life course career, and again, where I think we should spend a lot more time. I can share them with people later if they want them, but where we should spend a lot more time drilling down, especially in our applied anthropology classes, about how all of these issues map out in individual students' careers. And this is really the heart of the matter. I'm just showing it to you today because I know we have a bunch of presenters, and I don't have time to go into all of this, and probably next year I'll have more to say about it. But these are the kinds of issues really planning to write about next. I think this is the heart of the matter. How we can set students up for lifelong learning, how we can teach them better to recognize opportunities. But sometimes I'll hear stories from myself like, the opportunity is right in front of your face. How do you come to recognize that or know that? Or even if you don't know it's an opportunity, make the most of it when it just presents itself to you. Different types of mentoring that would be more than just about finding your first job. In the neoliberal angst-filled work world, people are always talking about, can the anthropologist get that job? Well, fine, there's plenty of good work already addressing that. How about if they wanted to really get a series of jobs or turn it into a coherent career? I feel like as a whole, the field has done nearly nothing there. Now, of course, in the kind of moment we're in, we're all talking a lot about, it's a very reflexive moment for anthropology, talking a lot about long-term career development. How can people in the long term, in my area, I've worked on the anthropology of aging for decades now, But whatever students are interested in, poverty, food security, the environment, the big issues of our day, if you need to start out working in these fields, how can you really make a career of that if you're not going to be in a single job, working on only a single or stable set of projects? How can you continue to drill down and work on the things you're really interested in that are important to you and your passions? And then I know that Elizabeth and Ryan have both done some work in this area, but the very beauty of studying soul-searching things, changing course over time, and failure, we can really do a lot more there, and it's super helpful if you do. And then, like I said, probably the biggest thing of all is this piece of getting people to really commit to working on the issues they want to for a lifetime as an anthropologist and really having the career they need to have. And with that in mind, I only have a couple of minutes left. You may be like, what's this? So I have brought my own prop. See, here's the real book. And I am both going to tell you how I got it and end with a couple of thoughts from it. So as you can see, the book is called Complete Guide to Starting a Used Bookstore. And I believe in the power of translating things across fields. So when I found this book, I thought there were some things in it that were apropos for summing up my first round of this discussion with you here. So basically, what happened was I found this book earlier this year. I literally found it in my public library on the free bookshelf, which is always a great thing. And I picked it up, and I thought it was kind of a fun fantasy. And please do not start a wild rumor. I know some people in this room that I am opening a bookstore, because I'm not. But basically, that's what the book is about. And the reason I bring it to you today is this author, Dale Gilbert. I was both pleased with what he had to say and annoyed because I might want to say some of those same things myself. But what he talks about is a few key things. How he got into the antiquarian book business, which is his area. How he talks about the importance of being happy as well as prosperous in your job field. And how, most importantly, how his lifelong career dream came true. And I really like the way he writes about that. So I'm going to end by reading you just an excerpt from his introduction and leave you hanging with that thought, and hopefully I'll be back next year with more to say about this. But this is what he says in his introduction. I like it a lot. He says, I felt compelled to write the following book, partly out of love and partly out of anger. As you read, I think this will become apparent. This is how it starts out. Love, because the antiquarian book business has given me most of what I wanted from life. And not just in the corporal sense. Anger, because the business can be at times so simple and straightforward, a half-bright 12-year-old could do some of it successfully, and yet too many used book dealers somehow manage to expletive the whole thing up. When I began in this business 15 years ago, I was just coming from a decade with one of the so-called Fortune 500 companies. That's supposed to be the staircase to success in this country, isn't it? Well, the truth is, I was depressed, sadly disillusioned, and damn near broke after working like a fool for Big Brother for 10 long years. I've been a collector of first editions of my favorite authors for years, and more as a source of comfort than security, I drifted into the antiquarian book business as a mail-order dealer. Little did I know how generously fate was to deal with me from that point on. And then he has one more short little paragraph that I think matters for this discussion. The body of this book is primarily concerned with the mechanics of how I managed all of this. Here I'd like to talk about the other, perhaps more important needs being a bookseller has filled in my life. The biggest surprise when I became a bookseller wasn't the money. It was the pride and satisfaction I felt as a tangible thing, a rosy glow I still enjoy today. What I'm trying to tell you is I don't believe there are very many applications in the world which make you feel as good about yourself and what you do as mine, fellow anthropologist. There you have the real wonder of what this book offers, a lifelong career which not only warms the belly, but the soul as well. I've tried to touch upon the sense of childish wonder and excitement that goes with the territory, too. If you decide to take the plunge and open a shop of your own, I hope the child you once were is not too far below the surface. He's going to be one of your main business assets, and he's going to have a fall. People, just to wrap up, it spoke to me. And I thought that much of this way of thinking is highly translatable for anthropological practice. The good news, which I'm not going to tell the audience here, is that there is great need for anthropological practitioners going forward. Yes, even today. We have many reasons to think that they can be successful and are able to lead in a globalized world. whether analytic insight and critical thinking skills are still much needed and will still matter going forward. We already have extensive writing of what they need in school, broad training in social science approaches, methods, technical skills, and plenty of hands-on opportunities to practice their skills. Now we need to come up with a better call for action for anthropology educators to encourage this kind of long-term anthropological career development and help our students to seek out and really find the careers of their dreams. Thank you.
I assume we'll have questions.
Yes, we will. So, where do you have all the stuff? I'm going to give you one.
Our next speaker is Anthony Ramos. Anthony is now a graduate student at CUNY in New York, and this past year he's been working with us at Purdue on our National Science Foundation grant to revolutionize engineering education.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me here today.
I moved it down.
There's also a band playing behind us right now, so okay, it may disrupt me. All right, so let me jump in. I think we're a few minutes behind. So what I want to discuss here today, in a short way, are the kinds of relationships which define the social space in the mechanical engineering school at Purdue. This research, as you can see in the slide, is part of the NSF-funded Revolutionizing Engineering Department's grant that seeks to answer the call for transforming engineering education through pedagogical change, as well as developing the social and cultural communication skills required for the professional formation of engineers. To make cultural changes, as you know, requires addressing an organization's milieu, and as I will emphasize later, the relationships within that particular organizational context. What is to follow is a brief summation of exploratory research that has been led by Edward Berger, an associate professor in engineering education and mechanical engineering at Purdue, as well as Elizabeth Bridey, who introduced me. This will be a summation of the ways in which relationships were perceived by the various social groups within the social space of the engineering school at Purdue. And in so doing, I will seek to first provide insight into the unevenness of the visibility of relationships within the engineering school's social space. Second, I want to use these insights to make a case for bringing intentionality to the relationships that are built and maintained within the school. And then lastly, I want to gesture ever so briefly at the ways in which these insights on relationships have already aided our understanding of the push points for changing the culture within that school in a manner which is in line with the pedagogical changes already underway and in the cultural changes the school seeks to make within its own organization. As you may have already gleaned, I will be using a Bogosian framework in my analysis of relationships in social space. And most of us are very familiar with his notion of social space, which uses a spatial analogy to describe the unevenness of arrangements and asymmetry of power dynamics in the constitution of a particular area within a larger social field. Many have also utilized Bourdieu's notion of cultural capital to describe the specific social formations that have been instilled and inherited in the makeup of a particular social space. Bourdieu sums up social space and cultural capital in this way. Social space is a multidimensional space constructed on the basis of principles of differentiation or distribution constituted by a set of properties active in the social universe under consideration. That is, able to confer force or power on those who possess cultural capital within that particular universe. These insights will form the basis of my theoretical basis. However, I want to emphasize an aspect of Bourdieu's notion of social space and cultural capital, and that has in many ways been overlooked by most people who use those notions. That is, I want to talk about very briefly relationships, or more precisely social relationships, which are the ongoing bundles of interactions and affective bonds by which a social space is reiterated and cultural capital is realized. Bourdieu himself spoke of social distance as a key element to understanding the larger concept of social space and cultural capital, and I'll refer to a passage in which he makes the case for understanding, for precisely looking at social distance, and this passage comes from his insights into the school system within France. He states the following: the school system contributes to reproducing the structure of the distribution of cultural capital and through it, the social structure, only to the extent to which this relational structure itself as a system of differences and distributions depends upon this distribution. In other words, he is speaking about social distances in conjunction with social differences. And I'm obviously focusing on the distance aspect. And very quickly, I want to point out that this does not necessarily denote a relationship between two people as having a quality of being distant. So there's a difference between distance and distant. You'll see later why that's important. And before I want to move to the next slide, I'm highlighting social distance within the engineering school in a manner which is productive, bringing intentionality to these relationships. My findings are based on open-ended interviews that were conducted by Elizabeth Bridie. We both coded the interviews separately, and we compared, and I would say productively disagreed quite often on what we were seeing. But we did come across a few thematics that we all noticed. And that was professor avoidance, the reliance of students on egalitarian student study groups, the present absence of diversity discourse, and what I'm discussing today, which is the lack of relationship building. Additionally, our findings have also been incorporated in recourse sessions already. These recourse sessions are where we bring faculty together to promote projects among the faculty. They largely concentrate on pedagogy and curriculum changes. We kept saying relationships, relationships, relationships. As well, I found it very interesting during these sessions what the faculty focused on and who focused on certain aspects. So those professors who were spoken about nicely by the students as having an approachable demeanor, they were far more receptive to understanding relationships as being important. While you had other faculty who were named as the bad apples, so to say, they were far more concerned about quantification, like the sample size and stuff like that. And I find that very interesting. You'll see why that's important here in a second. And so, based on the coding, what I coded for when I say relationship, I coded for the concept of relationship, not so that Sally said so-and-so, but more about the way that you, this relationship is not working well, I like an open relationship, I wish that person would talk to me, interact with me. And when it's a social fact and a social element is what I was coding for. And so this is what I produced. And I chose the core diagram because I wanted to be able to translate to engineers who use the quantification methods. Right, and so this core diagram, if you notice, on the outside are the different colors which correspond with the social groups. So blue is undergrad, purple is faculty, and the green is staff. And the bands, the colored bands, the color means that, like, if it's green, it's going from staff, and they're talking about faculty. If it's purple, you see purple is going to the undergraduates and staff. That means it's what faculty. These are the amount of mentions of relationships between the two different groups. And as you can see, undergraduates overwhelmingly discuss their relationships with faculty, right? And they discuss quite a bit with staff. But what's also is important to take what they were saying, right? The modality of these relationships. And so they discussed faculty in two manners. There were those who were open and approachable, and those who were distant and reserved. So as one student says about the distant reserved faculty, some are, I don't know what to say, cold. But they don't connect as well. They know the material very well. They can teach it, but I mean, they don't really get to know their students on a personal level. And that was spoken about in distinction. Another undergraduate spoke about an open, approachable faculty this way. Oh yeah, he really likes to connect with his students. A lot of professors, at least at Purdue, are like that. It wasn't hard at all to approach him because he's just very approachable. And so students also mention quite often a desire for more interaction with faculty. And this student sums it up as, I guess I want all of them to be more like Dr. So-and-so. And so these last two comments are actually speaking about one professor. You know who's always so approachable and willing to help with things? That could be like really one of the ways I could see to improve things. But I guess I haven't had a whole lot of problem with the way things are set up. Another student speaks about desire this way. Yes, people don't care how much you know until they know that you care. Basically, that kind of goes to what you say. It's like you're not going to go to a professor for extra help until they make it clear they don't care about they care about you as a student. How well you do in class and things like that, right? So that, just to reiterate, students spoke about relationships with faculty quite often, and they desired more interaction with those faculty. That can contrast with faculty who barely talk about relationships at all with anybody. Thank you. And they spoke about it this way. One faculty member says, and this is when they were actually speaking about relationships. I'm concentrating on what they said about undergraduates. I think most people have very good relationships with their students. I'm sure there are a few exceptions in school. I'm on a graduate committee, so I guess I know there are a few exceptions. But in general, in the department, I think there's a strong interest in student success. And that may be very well true, but as you can see from this diagram, they simply just don't talk about it that often. So there's something there that I think we need to tease out. Another faculty, though, did mention that these relationships are important to aspects of the culture, like mentorship, right? Relationships are necessary for mentorship. And one faculty said, it would be nice when students are struggling that it would be in an environment where they really feel they could come and interact with professors and move forward. It would be nice to have a much more mentoring environment. So at one hand, they said that we have an environment where relationships are the norm, or approachable relationships are the norm. On the other hand, they see a need to improve mentorship relationships. So there's more that we need to tease out here. Another faculty actually connected relationships to learning outcomes. I'm not really good at names, but if I work at it, then I can learn names, and to me, that is the single most effective tool in teaching a large class, is being able to call on someone by name. And that one was mentioned, I think, twice. So that is a strategy I think faculty are very aware of, but as I'm going to say over and over, they just simply don't talk about this. They talk about other things. And so these questions came along when we were just asking, what is the culture of mechanical engineering, right? So we weren't asking specifically about relationships, but in not asking specifically, we did come across some key insights. Thank you. And so this is our key findings. As you have seen, undergraduates will overwhelmingly more likely discuss relationships they have or don't have with faculty when discussing the culture of the engineering school. Moreover, many of the undergraduates who spoke of relationship with faculty mentioned that for the most part, the school social space is defined by cordial and friendly relationships with faculty. Notwithstanding, for those faculty who were instead described as distant and reserved, they stuck out like sore thumbs, were often quoted by name by these students. And while a couple faculty and a few undergraduates perceive relationships as crucial to not only a learning experience in a welcoming environment, they also noticed it was connected to learning outcomes. And that's why it's important that we have to think about why faculty aren't talking about these relationships. I emphasize perception because this is the aforementioned exploratory research that has yet to be confirmed through confirmatory research, which is very important for the engineers. Although there is research already that already exists, particularly out in Oklahoma, there's a connection between relationships within engineering schools and learning outcomes. And in conclusion, a social space is not only defined by accumulations and articulations of cultural capital and social power. Unequal power and capital and cultural capital most likely exist in educational institutions. The power dynamics between faculty and students are there for a reason. So these findings do not mean to imply that there's going to be a kumbaya moment in which egalitarianism emerges between students and faculty. Nor do I want to imply that the relationships defining the social space of engineering school are particularly negative. Rather, I want to emphasize that for students, relationships with faculty were overwhelmingly defined how they perceive that social space, and thus the culture. Thus, I'm contending it's crucial to bring intentionality to how these relationships are built, maintained, and to what purpose relationships are being built for. Reducing social distance between students and faculty must first begin with taking seriously the invisibility of these relationships among the faculty. Why aren't faculty talking about relationships with their students? And how they understand the culture. This must also occur alongside a serious uptake with what the students are desiring, which is relationships with their faculty. Social distance can be reduced by finding strategies that improve attendance of office hours, more engagements over email between students and faculty, and also increasing small informal interactions between faculty and students. Two students actually mentioned, "Can they just say hi to me?" was the things that they were asking, right? And these can have a huge impact when we bring in attention out to relationship building. And just not allowing relationship building to be ad hoc. It's something that happens, right? Emphasizing relationships will bring mentorship and student input on teaching strategies. and it'll bring this to the forefront in ways that are just not, you know, exist right now for most faculty. These types of relationships will undoubtedly help students thrive after graduation. As young engineers, they will rely not only on the technical skills that they develop during their time at the engineering school, but also just as crucially on those quote-unquote soft skills, which one of the engineering faculty said we should not talk about. I think he wanted to say professional, soft was too soft, I guess. Right? they have to rely on these soft skills needed to work productively in the collaborative environment, right? And lastly, bringing social relationships to the fore, and how students and faculty perceive the social space can have significant impacts on producing a welcoming environment in the engineering school. And this can have broad impacts, right? For instance, how the environment is experienced by traditionally underrepresented students, taking relationship building can seriously improve the retention and recruitment of diversity student body. That is actually, I think, point number 13 on the engineering, was it Engineering Society, I believe is the name, right? Right, there's a 14-point step of what engineering wants to improve, and one of those is diversity. They have a diversity issue. And then also, emphasizing relationships can, in a very tangible sense, improve the school's institutional legacy by cultivating the long-standing relationships which maintain the loyalty and support of alumni. I guess with that, I'd like to finish.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Yes, I'm done.
Woohoo.
Elizabeth, can you help us find?
Is that it today?
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Right there.
Just click on it. Bottom right.
Are you got that one?
Is that the latest one?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, come up and do it. Yours is, this is a different program than mine.
So now I'll give you a 5-minute warning.
Okay.
And then a 1-minute warning.
Okay.
That should be fine. Will you give me the warnings? Will you give me the warnings? You can do it from down there if you want.
Oh, and you're doing this.
Okay. Yeah,
sure.
I want to go over because we have a discussion.
Okay.
Dennis, it's not connecting.
Was it strange?
I know, but this, it's up, it's ready to go, and it's. I just clicked on this. Nothing's happening. You only had a PDF? Did you only have
No, I sent you the PowerPoint as well.
This is the PDF.
Yeah, so when you tell me that.
I changed the screen.
So you sent me a PDF.
I sent you just before that.
The PDF before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sent you the PowerPoint.
What?
Yours is going to be on my computer.
I have it on.
Oh, okay.
I've got your.
Okay.
I sent it.
Sorry, folks.
Yeah. The PDF I sent after.
This one?
Maybe this one.
November 6th.
Mm.
Yeah.
look at this one.
Is that to you?
Okay. And let's go to.
So our next speaker is Chris Miller, who is associate clinical professor at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for your patience. Sorry about that. Okay. So I want to thank Marianne and Elizabeth for organizing the panel, and Dennis for serving as our discussion. So thank you, and thank you all for being here. I'm a business and design anthropologist, as Elizabeth mentioned. I'm currently teaching in a business school, so I have this dubious title of being an associate clinical professor of innovation, and the innovation part makes me cringe. Not that I haven't done a lot of work in that area, but what I do in innovation is not what business and industry mean when they talk about innovation, which, as Natalie Hansen mentioned yesterday, is something that's going to make a lot of money really fast. I am going to be talking about my work, which is teaching business students how to apply social science perspectives and the design process, which is commonly known as design thinking, in to define and solve business problems, to develop strategies, and to understand people. So this is my third year at IIT Stewart, and prior to this, I taught for 7 years at the Savannah College of Art and Design, and there I introduced design students to social science research. So I've been an anomaly in my academic career. I've never taught in an anthropology department, which is fine, but it's somewhat problematic. So the challenge for me is that in my courses, I'm not asking students to build on prior knowledge that they've acquired from classes that they've already taken. Instead, I'm proposing that they consider an alternative approach and develop a skill set which for most of them is completely new and which might not align with what they think or they come to see as relevant to or useful in the careers that they imagine that they're going to have or they hope they're going to have. So why am I doing this? You know, why was I hired to teach business students about anthropology and design? The answer is that business schools for the last few decades now have been trying to keep up with the major disruptions that have rocked business and industry and ignited an accelerated pace of change. So business students are kind of aware of these changes. I mean, they're, you know, everybody is kind of aware of how fast things are changing. So in general, yes, they know that, but understanding this is not the right guy. Anyway, so understanding what this means is something different. So business schools are trying to prepare their students for the environments, mindset, skill sets, and practices that they will encounter without really knowing for certain what those are going to be. So what they do know is that the pace of change will continue to accelerate. So how do they prepare students to succeed in contexts that are characterized by increasingly rapid change? So business and industry, So business and industry think they found the answer in design. So for the past 15 plus years, they've been warming up to design, first experimenting by consulting with design firms on specific projects, and now embracing design as a strategic organizational imperative that's been signaled by a flurry of acquisitions. So this has been great news for designers and for design graduates who are seen to have like the right stuff for the current business environment in which the design-driven innovation is seen as crucial for a business survival. But it's not great news for graduates of any business program. So once, you know, if you had an MBA, you were considered to kind of have everything you needed to succeed in business. But today, MBA programs have become a commodity, and many of them are struggling to remain relevant. So this is a table of the pattern of acquisitions of design firms by major organizations, major corporations over the past 12 years, and especially since 2012.
So there are many reasons why, as this slide suggests, there's been this power shift towards customers. Why has this occurred? So it would seem as kind of a sidebar here that anthropologists with their deep expertise in understanding people would be industry's first choice to assist in making this shift. While that's happened to some extent, the reasons for why design has communicated its value in ways that anthropology has not is a topic that we could discuss for days. Design has clearly been industry's choice to lead efforts to refocus business on their customers or their users, and human-centered design has become a very potent force in business. So the significance of design in business is ballooning, and business schools have recognized that design, the design mindset, is something that their students need to acquire. So with business not only making major financial investments in design, but also making it a part of you, which is a quote that was on one of these slides, signals that the need for a major change in business school curriculums is something that the schools are trying to adapt to. But issues of trust and authenticity, believability play very heavily here. So embracing design kind of brings this mantle of authenticity, trustworthiness, and respectability to business, which is signaled by proclamations of empathy for customers, something that traditionally educated students of business cannot really provide. So in fact, they represent an opposite focus on profit-driven efficiency and stakeholder value. So, let's see, Daniel Pink was one of the first people to proclaim that the focus of business was shifting to design. The message has been received by some business schools faster than others. At the Stewart School, graduate school students from the Institute of Design, which is a very well-known design school globally, they're able to take a dual degree program where they can earn a master's in design and also an MBA, kind of in the same program. It's very progressive. However, an MBA student cannot enroll in a dual degree program where they earn an MBA and a design degree. Can't happen. So the Stewart School has instead attempted to patch in design thinking. It's only through preparing this presentation that I've been able to articulate my frustration with being the person designated to accomplish this feat. The strategy of patching it in, I'll tell you, it just doesn't work. So business schools aren't the only ones that are trying to be more disciplinary. We're seeing these new hybrid fields emerging all the time. Again, this is a discussion for another day. But what is even more interesting is if we look ahead, this concept of design thinking is being introduced far earlier in education. So this photo of a team of elementary schoolers designing a project was taken for a website about design thinking in early education. So this idea has caught on, like, well. Okay, so so in my second year of teaching at IIT, I surveyed my students, my business students, to find out what they had to say about design and about the content of the course I had developed. I quickly will present some results from this undergrad study, which was conducted in April of last year, over about a 10-day period, and there were about 2 weeks left to the term, so they had had pretty much what they were going to get. So I was very interested in understanding, I can't get into a whole lot of the detail here, but I would be happy to present the slides. So I'm going to go through these slides fairly quickly because it's a lot of just survey data, which might not be all that interesting. But their perception of how design thinking was taught through project-based learning and course content was a little bit less positive than their appreciation for what design thinking would mean in their careers going forward. So they kind of got that. So the results of this single survey suggest that design thinking is generally understood by these undergraduate senior students. This was a capstone course. Was perceived to be important, but the text that they used and the design tools were perceived to be a little less likely to be helpful, so I'm working on that because I'll be teaching this course next semester. So There were a lot of very interesting responses to the open-ended questions, which provided me with some useful insights and actionable insights. And they highlighted some areas that need improvement. And some of the students clearly were committed to the design process. You can see this one talks about being like 100 million percent committed to the design process. So, I mean, some of them were really on board with this. Others, not so much. So while some students were heavily invested in finance and in areas that were very quantitative, they seemed to perceive that the design process was less relevant and less valuable in solving the kind of problems that they expected to encounter in their careers. Thank you. Yeah, I'll get there.
Okay.
Let's see. At IIT, students are required to take two interdisciplinary courses. They're called their professional practice or IPRO courses that give these students an opportunity and an experience of being on a cross-disciplinary team. But not all students have a great experience in their IPRO courses, and clearly this comment seems to bear some resentment, right, about not having design thinking shoved down our throats. Oh, it's important, right? But, you know, like how much is enough? To sum up, oh, there's more. Right, and in this one, in this comment, there's this student is talking about the fact that there's a perception that there is this thing called deliberate design, and then there's something that's less focused and less intentional. I couldn't quite decode what was going on here, but I thought it was interesting that, you know, it's like throwing things out until it sticks, right? You're just going to throw enough mud at the wall until it sticks. Not good. So, in conclusion here, you know, what do how do students perceive as the value of design thinking? What do they see? So, you know, most see that it has some value. They get that. Some see that it has a great deal of value, and some don't see much value at all. So that's interesting. And then there's a lot of research that has to be done yet on how companies think about that employ our business school graduates. What do they think about design, and whether it's important that their employees can apply the design process to identify and solve problems and to understand people? I mean, do the employers, do they think it's important? And that research has not been done. Those questions have not really been asked. So, in conclusion, this is what I've learned from my students in the 2.5 years that I've been teaching in this program. So what I decided after, you know, preparing for this presentation is that the next time I teach this course in the spring, I'm going to start from their perspective. I'm going to find out what, you know, where are they, what do they know, what have they already done. So the course needs to be more learner-centric than I've been in the past. So I want to start at their level by establishing what their previous experience is. And then to continue to demonstrate the value and the relevance of social science and the design process specifically to them as business students, not just in general. That might mean bringing in some guest lecturers from business who believe in and value these approaches based on their own professional experience. I also intend not to do the kind of teaching that's considered conventional, where, you know, I'll teach my point of view to you. That's not going to happen. And I also realize now that half steps are insufficient in introducing something that's almost contradictory to the socialization that a lot of the students have already had to quantitative types of approaches. And the salad courses where you have a little of this, a little of that, they don't work. Patching in social science and design just doesn't work. It keeps these very important fields marginalized and communicates that they are less important and kind of like, you know, if you get this, that's okay. But there really needs to be a commitment to social science perspective and the design process from the top of the from the top of the school. That means it has to start with the dean and it has to come across the curriculum. So this is what I've learned, and thank you for listening. And it's kind of the front end of this, so look forward to your comments. Thank you.
Julia.
Yes.
Yes.
Our next speaker is Julia Wignall, and she is at Seattle Children's Hospital.
Hello. So I want to talk kind of about two different ideas. One of them is I'm more on the recent side of graduating with my master's in applied anthropology, so I want to talk about how I translated that degree into a job at a hospital, and then I want to talk about what I feel the role of ethnography plays in this setting for me, in my experience. So this is Seattle Children's Hospital. I work in the Division of Experience. I work with patient and family experience, and primarily I help the hospital and different clinics and units in the hospital understand their patient and family experience survey data. I help them understand the trends, and then I help, I go in, I do rapid ethnography, and I help them think about what actually would be a meaningful action to take to impact the patient and family experience. So when I started, when I finished my graduate degree, I was already working at the hospital, and I would tell anyone that would listen my pitch, which is right here. And the reason I share this with you is because this is how I found to make anthropology approachable to healthcare. In my master's work, I studied how undocumented college students access higher education, and I really could see that in the big picture, in the broad spectrum of what I was trying to understand, is how institutions can impact an individual in their daily lives. And so I took this and I started telling everyone I knew, and I just happened to meet an institutional gatekeeper that really got this and was willing to try it out. So for everyone, I think it's kind of important to think about how people translate their degree to a career. Susan went to take pictures. Yeah, okay, cool. So this is why my boss hired me. This is the list. I actually talked with her with this to make this list. And really, we wanted to hear from families in other ways than we were currently doing. A lot of it is this quantitative survey data, for the most part, or complaints. We rely on families to come to us with problems. We rely on them to tell us things. We wanted to give them an easy way to provide us information by going to them instead of waiting for them to come to us. And we also wanted to hear from families who aren't health literate, who aren't acculturated, who aren't a part of a healthcare system, who don't understand it. And right now, there really wasn't a lot of ways to hear from those folks. And then also my life experiences of working with marginalized people, living abroad, all of this helped my boss. When we talked about this, she was like, I feel like you can translate lived experiences to our institution. And then finally, helping to create an understanding. So a lot of the clinics and units with their patient and family experience surveys were asking, like, what do patients and families really mean? Like, if they say a provider didn't really know their medical history, like, what does that even mean? And how does that actually play out in the relationships and the communication that it happens, and how is knowledge shared? So that's kind of why she hired me and what I ended up trying to answer through this work. So in healthcare, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement created this thing called the Triple Aim, which has recently been adopted into the Quadruple Aim. And what has been added to it is satisfied providers. That actually didn't used to be a part of it. And many times in experience work, providers and patient needs are at odds. For example, to reduce costs, many healthcare organizations require providers to see patients quicker, to increase their volume while decreasing the cost of individual visits. Many providers lack autonomy over their day. They have no control over their schedule, what hours they work, or how fast they work, and this leads to them feeling unsupported. It leads to provider burnout, and it ultimately impacts the patient and family experience. And so there is this true calling right now in healthcare to get back to the original goal of healthcare, which is to reduce suffering for all. There are a million standardized approaches to improvement and quality improvement work, specifically in hospitals. I'm not going to talk about them to a large extent here, but I do feel that ethnography can actually play a really key role in supporting all of these. I think it's a very unique and different strategy. So in a lot of these approaches, it's all about measurement. Like, how can you measure the success of these strategies? If we streamline a process, then how do we measure the outcome of streamlining that process? How do we show that it was successful? And traditionally, it's really hard to measure things like emotions, communication, power, and relationships. And so it's really hard to communicate how these things have been changed or improved through improvements, through strategies like these. And a lot of communication tools that healthcare uses fail to remain intact because they're a top-down approach to changing behavior. So this one on the bottom right, that's one that my hospital uses. And many of these interventions, like KIDS, are created by the organization who then tells staff, this is how to interact or communicate without allowing for individuality or communication practices and authenticity in relationships. And then these tools are monitored through top-down approaches, like auditing, to see if people did or didn't use the tool. And then these approaches tell providers and staff that they aren't capable to or reliable to maintain basic communication, and so rather than promoting positive relationships, they feed this sense of insecurity and institutional control. So, with all of that, you've heard a little bit about human-centered design, and I've heard other people talking about it here. And this is something that we're kind of piloting right now in healthcare, like how can we use human-centered design within quality improvement? And the main thing I wanted to say is traditionally right now, a lot of the standardized approaches we use are more focused on the service design, so more focused on service systems rather than actually social systems, more focused on bringing in stakeholders rather than an entire community, using indirect understanding of an audience, whereas human-centered design is really focused on this direct understanding, which is where I think ethnography plays a huge piece. And then they're really focused on improving a system or process rather than empowering the people who are part of a system and process. And in fact, one of the main methodology we use at the hospital is called continuous process improvement, and their whole slogan is, it's the process, not the people. But we also think pathologists that a process cannot exist without people. So I love these pictures. Bad design is everywhere, and many times the products or services we create don't actually fulfill the intended purpose or have unintended consequences. So this picture over here on the right, it looks like Kool-Aid. It's actually bleach. This one on the bottom right is how they labeled the Miss Universe, where they actually called out the wrong name of Miss Universe. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. You can tell like how you read it. It's just not intuitive. My favorite is the pencils. Or the urinals. The elevator buttons, it's hard to tell actually which one goes where. And actually I thought, when I was putting together this slide, I thought a lot about anthropology and the four field approach and how understanding how humans have used tools or why they've created tools in the past or how linguistics play into design. I think there's actually a lot of opportunity just for anthropology in general when we talk about design. But for me, so what I think about, the reason I bring up design is really thinking about how we bring together communication and relationships in with design, especially within healthcare. So I spend a lot of time in rooms like this. I started a program at the hospital called Patient Tracers. That's the official term. The word tracers, it comes from the Joint Commission, which is an organization that accredits and certifies hospitals across the country. They use what they call a tracer methodology to follow patients while they're doing their accreditation process. So using that term was intentional to make it an approachable process for everyone in our institution. They were already familiar with what that term meant. But I still get a lot of resistance, and that's mostly from healthcare workers, not from patients and families. And it's really around this auditing culture that exists in healthcare and feeling that we're going to be judged. So since January 2014, that's when I started this work, we have talked, with over 260 patients and families in about 27 different clinics and units in the hospital, 8 different sites of care. It's really been broad-spanning, and it's these kind of short, iterative, rapid ethnography kind of practices that we are using. When we first started, we actually worked with clinics and units who were low scoring on that family experience survey, like I was talking about. A lot of them were like, we have tried everything, we don't know what else to do, felt very stuck with what they could do that could actually have an impact on patients and families. And so that's where we started. And I wanted to give one example really quick. Let's see. So in July, I have a million examples, so if you want to ask me, please do. But one is that in July 2015, I was observing in the infusion clinic, and I was talking with teen patients and parents, and the clinic had recently switched to these new pumps where the nurses have to check on the patients every 15 minutes. And when I talked with patients and families, I learned that they felt really negatively about these pumps. Like, the kids, like, one of the first things they would say to me, like, oh my god, I hate these new pumps. That's pretty much how they talked about it. And when I was talking with them why, they talked about how when they switched to them, the nurses expressed a lack of confidence and annoyance about the pumps, and these emotions were transferred onto the patients, and they, who also found them annoying. And in addition, previously, before that, patients were used to sitting about 1 hour to 2 hours. Infusions can be about 6 to 8 hours long, so being checked every 15 minutes is actually a lot when you're, like, sitting there watching a movie, getting your infusion. They were used to being checked, like, 1 hour or 2 hours apart before that, so now they're experiencing a lot of interruptions. And also, they spoke a lot, but it was actually amazing because they spoke a lot about their concern for their nurses. So it's extremely busy in infusion clinics. Nurses are kind of, like, there's always people walking around. The nurses are very busy. And they actually were worried that it was placing more burden on the nurses. And they were concerned that then those nurses were less able to get to patients who really needed help. And so when I went and I shared this with the leadership team, they talked about how, like, yes, the nurses had been trained, but they hadn't passed on the knowledge to patients and families how much safer these pumps were. The 15-minute check basically made it virtually impossible for there to be serious safety errors while getting infusions. So, but the patients didn't know that. And so through this, it became apparent that at times hospitals have to pick safety as a higher priority over experience. And it really kind of underlines some of these bigger questions, like how do we negotiate priorities during treatment? How do changes like this impact experience for everyone? And ultimately, how do we make the right business choices within healthcare? So I really wanted to talk about, like, is ethnography a cultural shift in healthcare? And cultural shifts really come through individuals, through a change in their ideology. It's kind of like a gradual, one person at a time. And I wanted to think about, like, what are we trying to do by doing ethnography in a hospital? And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to make everyone feel valued and heard and listened to. We're trying to change, improve our patient and family experience survey data, our outcomes. And we're trying to improve relationships. And we're trying to get people to move from this feeling of being victimized, both for providers and patients, to becoming, feeling like they're empowered and satisfied individuals. So, I really see quality improvement ethnography as playing a critical role in hospitals and healthcare because it's actually a proactive approach to dealing with problems and creating understanding. So healthcare is really reactive. It's built to respond to symptoms or patient grievances or complaints. And that's not just diagnostically, but even employee complaints. All of our systems are based, rather than like tell us ahead of time what you think the problems might be, we have like an e-feedback system where you input things anonymously and get feedback. And so with participant observation, we're taking a proactive approach, and we're asking, what can we do to keep you healthy? So rather than relying on survey data or other large data sets to determine areas of opportunity or change, we're taking the time to understand the impact of processes on the people who either do the work or are experiencing the outcome. So ultimately, to me, I feel that as an anthropologist in this setting, I am a mediator of institutional practices and individual experiences. I'm trying to bring the theoretical to life. I'm trying to create actionable insights, and I'm trying to start by taking the time to ask the right question from the get-go. So a lot of times people will come to me, like the endocrine clinic was wondering with their diabetes patients, what adds value to an appointment? So translating that into something where I could actually get something back from them. What I ended up doing for that was using the card sort method and asking families what was most important to discuss during their visits and have them pick which images correlated with that. And then with young patients, because we're a children's hospital, I asked them what was most fun about their visits and had them pick out what they liked about their visits with their doctors. And so finally, being an institutional member affords me access and trust that I could never have being a consultant. I have a lot of insider knowledge of being part of this institution, and I think that helps advance the work that I'm able to do.
Marianne McKay from Cultural Connections and the University of Rochester is now going to talk about customer and employee goals.
Thank you, Elizabeth. In the practice of capitalism today, many companies follow what Jacob Kraft Jensen calls values-based management in his study of a well-known design firm in Copenhagen. Values-based management, which means there should be some consistency between what a corporation says and does as they speak out loud to their internal and external audience and are creating meaning for them. So I'm concerned with values-based management in distributed business, sometimes called decentralized business. That is, companies that are providing outsourced services to other companies, like schools and hospitals, or corporate offices, retail stores, etc. For example, schools may outsource food services. Hospitals may outsource cleaning services or lab services. So a distributed business, then, is one that provides the outsourced services, that sends its employees to the schools, to the hospitals, and to other organizations to deliver these food services or lab services, whatever. And since outsourcing is a growing business practice, distributed businesses, I think, are a good place to look at the relationship between learning processes and workplace expectations. So in this presentation, which will be a case study, I focus on value placed on education and advancement for employees in distributed businesses, where human service development and everyday work, or education and everyday work, occur in the same place, in the same institution. We're not having a university over here like Chris Miller's and a workplace over there. It's all happening same place. The question that our session has raised is, I didn't finish that slide. And I found that emotional attachments and loyalties are key for the whole learning process and the workplace expectations. And that's because employees' feelings emanate from connections to two different cultural domains. They're like a yo-yo. They're connected to their company, the distributed business itself, and yet they're connected to the client companies, the school, the kids in the school, the teachers in the school, or they're the customers of the distributed business. Gets to be a mouthful. Anyway, the session question we've raised is how closely aligned should these two domains be culturally? So the case study is of Sodexo, which is a global company headquartered in France. The majority of its operations, about 70%, are in Europe and the United States, about 35% in each region. The rest I've already said. You did notice that it says Sodexo Quality of Life Services. That's what it says it provides. Does it do it? Oops. So the purpose of the research that I did was to ask, well, okay, what does quality of life mean to you, speaking to employees? And the work I did with the company was part of a larger company project exploring the meaning of quality of life amongst not only employees but also customers in seven different parts of the world. So I was just doing a little piece of the research here in the United States with employees. This image, Island Time, wouldn't it be nice, especially given the weather outside today, comes from one of the collages that the research participants made. And all of the images, except the next one, come from the employee collages. So the way we did it was to have four group interviews, with three of those with frontline employees, the ones who go to the schools and the hospitals and the corporate offices. This photo is from one of the places where we held the group interviews. It's a Colgate-Palmolive office, and Colgate-Palmolive is actually one of the clients of Sodexo. So Sodexo will send its mechanics and its, I don't know, lawnmowing people, you know, keep the outside, to a place like that. Now, what we found is that the employees in the distributed business really live in a liminal space. On one hand, they are connected on your left side to higher management, Sodexo, the company they work for, and on the other, to the clients, or the Sodexo's customers. So it's the people at the school or hospital, wherever they're working. The irony of this liminal space, as you can read from the person below, is that they don't really feel connected to the company. Their everyday relationships are with people at the school or hospital or corporate office. Sodexo is invisible, name on a paycheck. So this picture from the collage is the kids that they work with at the school, and not Sodexo. So the perception that the company doesn't care about them stems in part from working in a decentralized business. Sodexo is present to them in their everyday relationships, but not to this invisible company. So let's take a look at what quality of life means. A very potent symbol for employees. It encompasses what's important in their personal and professional lives. For example, respect and teamwork at work, as well as at home. Most of the employees were quite happy at Sodexo, and the image on the left reflects that. They work for a company that's very innovative, see on the bottom left. It's successful because it adapts to a changing environment, and it's a chameleon. So they're happy in that sense. They've got a job. Not everybody has a job. They're grateful. But there are experiences in the workplace which make them feel like the character on the right going, ah! And it's those the dissatisfactions that need to be addressed by the company so that quality of life does come alive in the work experience. Here are the words that the employees used. A lot of them reflect the emotion that they feel. Now, if that's quality of life, what were the employee concerns in the workplace? The reasons they were not so happy. First, advancement. There was little opportunity for promotion and getting ahead. Compensation. Lots of complaints about that. For example, recent cuts in healthcare benefits, wondering, well, how come this guy over here makes X dollars? He's at this school doing the same job as I, and I'm not making that much. That's not fair. But, of course, Sodexo, the distributed business, is making contracts with each of its clients, and those contracts may have different salary levels in them. Or another employee who was officially part-time, but he worked 37 hours a week. And, yes, a little exploitation going on. And had asked his local manager for a full-time job. The manager said, I'm sorry, but it just isn't available. And the last concern was lack of recognition for their hard work and loyalty. Just a simple thank you was really what they wanted. Also, on the local sites, the schools, the hospitals, the corporate offices, are some local managers. Their concerns were these. First, work overload. They said they were working almost 80 hours a week, so that was a problem. They didn't have enough money or resources to hire the right people instead of just a body to fill a job. And very interestingly, they said there was a lack of training for their hourly employees. And that matches up with what the employees were saying. I think Sodexo has some good programs for training managers to go up and become part of hire management, but not to raise the hourly workers up. And finally, they felt the need to have some resources to develop a company spirit. So, in conclusion, yes, I think that perceived cultural distances matter in a distributed business. For here we have the employees way over on the right-hand side, feeling disconnected, feeling disappointed, discontent. The corporate discourse on quality of life doesn't really match the corporate practices. They're not doing what they're saying. So there's insufficient consistency between the language and action in the value-based management of the distributed business. That is, according to the frontline employees who are seeking new skill sets and career tracks. And that perceived cultural distance and access to training and advancement on the left, of course, is a relationship of power, which the company has. Now, this was a kind of a surprise learning for the human resources department for which we were doing the research. And their response was first to say, well, you know, we have a respectable turnover rate. People aren't leaving left and right, and that's true. They have more long-term employees, 10, 20 years, than short-term employees. Good thing. And the HR people also talked about their engagement measures at the company, which show employees feeling happy, content, feeling productive, connected to their coworkers, and that is also true based on the ethnographic work we did. But the company had not measured employee interest in advancement and training and going further with the company, and they were very accepting of the results and said that they would pursue those findings through their employee survey. Are you marking my time?
No.
Oh. Well, I want to make sure we leave Dennis plenty of time. Okay. So I left the senior VP of human resources with them promising to pursue. And frankly, I don't know what happened. That was a project that ended with my walking out the door. But it does lead us to think about business as a social process, as previous speakers have talked about, in the global service economy. And so this final slide shows the role of emotion over time in business-to-business relationships. Just my thought. If you start at these circles at the bottom left, we have point of sale. So let's say a computer company is selling its products to other companies. The connection is more momentary, point of sale. Then we can move up to a project-bound engagement, so where there's a longer than point of sale connection, but it is time bound. So think about a management consulting firm helping a company design design a reorganization plan. That might be a week, a month, 2 months, but it's time limited. We have outsourcing business to business relationships in terms of parts and supplies, and that might be a long-term contract, enduring intent for the foreseeable future. But it's not the same as outsourcing people. So if you're outsourcing parts and supplies, yes, you've got a company manager visiting the place where they're outsourced, and having a B2B relationship. But it's not the intensity of outsourcing people. Where, as we have seen, the longer and deeper emotional connections can lead to satisfaction as well as dissatisfaction and conflict that needs to be addressed. So with that, I will invite Dennis, our discussant, to come up and speak. Dennis, do you want your computer? Huh?
No. Well, good afternoon. Looks like everybody ought to get up and move around a little bit. So go ahead and do that if you care to. I just got up from the chair and walked up here, so I got my little exercise.
Me too.
So it's so nice to be invited to this occasion and to have the opportunity to thoughts and comments and sometimes critical comments in order to improve what kind of work is being done. In Ryle Nolan's edited 2013 book, Handbook of Practicing Anthropology, I contributed the chapter titled Anthropologists Working in Higher Education, where I delineate the various employment positions anthropologists can succeed at, by being other than a professor and a teacher. And so I'm giving you this a little idea of the position of where I'm coming from in regards to my critique. And so early in my professional career, after receiving my PhD, I quickly became a director of a mental health center and a president of my own company, which did research in the community in South Florida. And so, and then I was a teacher in a local university. So over time, I was able to be drawn into the university, and over these decades, I have many fulfilling roles, teacher, researcher. I was a strategic planner for the entire university, developer of the university policies. I was the accreditation officer representing the president to the regional accrediting agency. I was the director of program review, where I did program, hundreds of program reviews and accountabilities. And I feel honored that after all these many decades, about a decade ago, I was able to shift out of those very applied practicing roles over into an academic department. So now I'm in the role in the Department of Global and Sociocultural Studies, where I, as a practitioner and an applied anthropologist, that can share that knowledge with the students. And we have a doctoral program in Global and Sociocultural Studies. And so currently I'm the director of the Global Indigenous Forum, which brings together indigenous voices and issues to the university and the world. And also in that task, I was a director of the undergraduate director in my department, advising students. So some of these points I just mentioned to you are going to be reflected in the kind of comments that I'm talking about. And so my own life career trajectory, as Cheryl Briller was talking about, the life course trajectory, what she was trying to bring forth is, I believe, a common pattern with most anthropologists, because most of us don't get, the professor job. So most of us are out there in the world making a living with this anthropological approach. And so the life career trajectory that you were able to add, I believe that's the common process. And so what you're working at is a fundamental to sharing, and also to the idea of having that being taught in the curriculum, in our applied programs, and even not in our applied programs, that was a very useful comment and something that ought to be done. Thinking in the long run instead of immediately, what am I going to do for a job? And so overall, this session posed a number of questions. The relationship between education and work, how closely aligned should two domains be culturally, and to what extent do the values embedded in education and work settings mirror each one? And so after receiving the papers over the last 2 weeks and then seeing them again today, they came together beautifully, and there's lots of important things here that need to be said. But I believe the session where topic which was originally conceptualized of the universities as a culture, and then the workplace, different cultures. What are we doing in the university, and how that's aligned with the actual employment opportunities? I don't think the whole collection of papers got there. You know, there's maybe two of them that were really right on that target. And so it's hard for me as a discussant then to discuss that major point when all the papers were a little bit aligned in different ways. How about I say that? All right. So with Cheryl's point, some of her comments is, it all gets used. Flexible thinking, the idea of storytelling and testimonials, but this idea of long-term anthropological engagement needs to be refined and communicated to the students in the educational program. So it's just not to get a job, but to keep being professionally engaged. Come back to our academic organizations, NAPA, Society for Applied Anthropology. Have a value there of being engaged. So many people, I'm the former president of NAPA, and I know the trajectory of many, many people. They'll be here for a short period of time, and then they'll be gone. The people gain the identities of their workplace. Our very last paper was just that. The distributed model, where the people are involved in their organizations, they gain the identity of those organizations, and they lose the identity of the main culture that they're from. So how do we build that sharing back and forth of the two domains? And so it's not the domain from the organization and workplace back to the university, but it's the sharing back to the professional organization. Mm-hmm. And so with Revolutionizing Engineering Education by Anthony Ramos and Elizabeth Brody and Edward Berger, that paper is actually the one that's closest to this idea of comparing the university with the, in the social organizations. And so this idea of her, the results of this duality of undergraduate interviews where professors are avoiding and counterbalanced by the tight social group of the students, you know, it's a very interesting finding and it's probably very, very useful for that department to then take actions. And so the whole list of things that, that they are proposing to the department are very practical, doable, and the reasonable things to do. So based on the research, the outcomes in, should be fairly clear on motivating faculty to design ways to work better with the students. And they use the idea from Bourdieu on social space and symbolic power. And so that is a very useful way of conceptualizing their model and how this all goes together. So might I suggest that the acknowledging and the importance of social relationships and learning, mentorships, tutoring, welcoming environment, social space outside the class, tutorial rooms, all of these are very important for the mechanical engineering department to hear. But I've been in university for in roles where I can see how to change organizational culture. And so I might try to broaden your view of culture. So it's not just symbols and social relationships. But culture is more than symbols and social relationships. And as anthropologists, we have a holistic perspective incorporating the full range of humanness. So symbolic or cognitive, the social and the material artifacts are also important. And so interviews of students' opinions of faculty is just one of the factors to understand the culture of the mechanical engineering department. And so there are many different structural factors which I could suggest actually are ways for that department to change. Because it's not necessarily the faculty and the perceptions and the symbols, but there's social, structural, and built environment issues that are of concern here. And just to give you an example, this is probably a research university where faculty are annually evaluated on their research, publications, patents, and inventions. And teaching is actually way low on how they're actually evaluated and rewarded. And if that's the case, that's why they're avoiding eye contact, is that they can't spend much time with the students. They got to be producing in this other way. That's a larger structural issue that you don't get to by just talking social relationships. And also, what is the student-faculty ratio? If you have very large classes, don't have much time. But also, the physical layout of the student and the distance from faculty offices. I know some very recent buildings built on our campus today, which are beautiful and artistically designed, but the humanness, it's not designed for human interaction. So even in new buildings, student areas are often off the route of where faculty are. And so it's the built environment, the built culture. And so the faculty offices are in places where you can't even encourage interactions or eye contact. It's because of the built environment. And also, in a great majority of our universities, the number of adjuncts are sometimes over 50% more than the 50% of the total faculty are adjuncts. And so they outnumber the regular full-time faculty. And adjuncts often have no office space to meet with students and are employed in other organizations, so their time on campus to be with the students is minimal. So these are other structural factors that in your recommendation to the dean, you know, of that department, some of these are actually, the political economy, materialistic kind of explanations, but that ought to be included in anthropology. I see so many contract anthropologists doing the work, and anthropology seems to be, you study the values and the symbols, and once you get into that kind of contract, it limits what you can say. And so with Christine introducing business students to design thinking, she starts with a kind of a change model of disruption and adaptation. and that there's a historical change occurring in U.S. businesses and universities, and specifically this idea of the shift to the consumer and the power of the consumer. And so that's where we're drawing upon, that's where she identifies that we're the draw of anthropology is that we are considered experts at understanding the local perspectives, consumers, and now we have this human-centered design. So I liked her a way of doing surveys of students in class, but there's some kind of comments that I'd like to make, because she asked the question, before taking this course, I understood the value of design thinking for solving business problems. The average was 3.9 out of 5. That's a pretty high score. So before they even got in the class, the knowledge about design was quite high. And then there was another question a little later on. Now that you've taken the course, does it help you explain design to your employer? That's 3.8. Looks like you went down on the scale. So I'm not sure why that is, but it's something you can address. And so, but I like the way you conclude that we need more research, how do employers think of design, and that's a goal of yet to do. So how, what, and how do employers expect, what do they expect? And that's back to the theme of the whole session. We have the university, the training, and we have the employer. And so you didn't get to the employer side, so we're back on the theme of the session is lacking because of that. But one point I think needs to be stressed is that I come, in reading the PowerPoint in advance and hearing your talk, I don't think you ever really clearly define what design thinking is or design anthropology. It's just not there. And even the key phrases, so I'm kind of left at, well, what is the difference? That really needs to be right up front. And it needs to be down in the end, too, where you wrap things up and say, this is what design thinking is all about, and this is how it should be done and can be beneficial. And also the disruption and adaptation model that you're using. I'm not sure where that comes from as a theoretical perspective. And the references are business-type popular publications. So I'd suggest kind of grounding it explicitly in a theoretical way. And Julia Wignall's Seattle Children's Hospital, the anthropology's role. I like where she said, where's Julia? Over here. I like your slide that says, here's my pitch, and this is how you need to introduce yourself. I think that's really core to training a future anthropologist. I think in Napa we've had elevator talk. In so many seconds, how can you explain yourself? But that's something that needs to be done more. And so this quality improvement ethnography at Seattle's Children's Hospital, she left out a good number of slides, which I wish you would have left them in there, because I thought they were core. And then I just met you, and so to see that you're so young, but you've been through so many different quality improvement case studies. Best practices and opportunities, family experience survey, child wellness clinic, nutrition clinics, improvement planning, bedside nursing, shift change, added value to diabetes clinic appointments, transplant value system, urgent care experience. She's done 7 independent projects, and so she really comes with quite a bit of experience here in showing how an anthropologist can move between within the institution of the culture, the health culture of the hospital, how she can actually move from place to place and bring the anthropology perspective, the human side of this, and actually the reason she's being asked to move from one project to another is she's successful. They're asking her to keep doing it. So that's really cool, yeah. But, all right. And so towards the end, you talk about emphasizing patient-centered care and theoretical models of real life. And so once again, my story here is that we need to be more explicit on the theories that we're using. And so what does that mean, models of real life? And so I like your approach of moving from reactive to proactive, that is all fine. And in your citations, you include Bordeaux, outline a theory of practice, but you never explicitly say what how this is all about. Or, and this is an anthropology audience, so we come, we're talking to anthropologists, and so some of these things are best to be heard. And so Marianne McCabe, aligning customer and employee goals and value-based management, once again, as I've critiqued others, values-based management was used in the beginning and the end, but I'm not sure what that means. You know, it wasn't, once again, it wasn't explicit to then hold the whole thing together. Here you start with that and you end with it. So I guess we come from, each of us, from a, we have our own jargon, right? We have our own words, and it makes sense. And so we need to clarify when we're talking to an audience like this. But these values of in this distributed model, how closely aligned should two domains be? This idea of liminal space and little connection, and they're happy, but there's frustrations with the focus groups. And can you imagine a company with 420,000 employees? That's big time, you know. And so, in 80 different countries, and you can do it with four focus groups. So this corporate discourse of respectable turnover rate and engagement when showing the employee contentment is all very powerful. But this idea of people being in a distributed company and relating back, that idea of sharing two different cultures and how do you get them aligned, I think it's a very good model to tickle out or to define better this, the purpose of the session, you know, the different cultures and alignment. And so our primary purpose for the session was to explore the relationship between perceptions of the universities and the world of work. It aimed to identify commonalities and differences between education students receive in university settings and expectations related to the workplace of their employment. So there, I think the number of papers that specifically got to the university versus employment were limited. So Cheryl Briller was able to reflect on the career life courses and skills needed. Very self-ethnographic approach. Briody's work surveyed the perceptions of students and faculty within a mechanical engineering department. But the employment outside the mechanical engineering was not included there either. So what was powerful there was the idea of social space and distance. Christine Miller compared business schools and design schools, skills needed for employment with business schools and design, and explored the perception of students in design course to their careers. Wignall demonstrates that anthropologists can do healthcare in institutions, quality improvement, ethnography, idea of cultural shifts, all of that is very important. Marianne McCabe, the idea of value-based management, we need to hear more about that. Perceived cultural differences matter, and business is a social process. The idea she showed at the end with the business is a social process, that can be heightened and elaborated more. So my contribution to this research is I have many publications on academic culture, organizational culture, directed organizational culture change, and I can see that all of the papers deal the commonality of anthropology, working with individuals, person-centered, user-centered, student-centered, local realities, perceptions, and symbols. What I'd like to see is connections to larger systems. You know, my critique of the mechanical engineering, the more structural things. But where is the concept of culture here, organizational culture? So I think we have an opportunity as anthropologists to keep refining that. And so in my own area, I work with cultural themes and how themes in certain cultures are reflected. So when you're only working with individuals and you're doing focus groups or individual interviews, the results that you got is fine, but it's at the individual level. A lot of that, they're reflecting a larger culture of the organization. And nobody, I don't think, moved to that level at all. What is the culture that the people, the milieu that they're living in, and does those comments and the words they're using reflect the larger culture? And so a lot of you are making recommendations on how to change the users. And I'm saying you can shift to, well, how do you change the larger culture? Because people move in and out of the society and their roles, in their place, but the culture remains there. And so how do we make effective cultural change at that level? And so as practicing and applied anthropologists, we have the ability to use a vast array of theories and methods, and to use them to focus our attention on solving problems. I might say that as applied anthropologists, we also have the opportunity to affect the discipline of anthropology. So now I'm talking about us affecting the discipline of anthropology by utilizing and developing generalizable knowledge that is applicable beyond our immediate study group to other human situations. And so the documenting, I see that a lot of our work here is the documenting of our endeavors in work and learning organizations is noteworthy as we share these skills with those who would like to follow these careers or conduct similar research. So a lot of the skills were very clearly outlined here. But I'm challenging you to move to more generalizable theories that are not only beneficial to the communities that we're engaged with, but to organizational analysis and to anthropology. And in many cases, this just means make more explicit what is implicit in the work. And so when we come to the American Anthropology meetings, if we want to have an effect on the larger discipline, we have to talk theory a little bit more than what we saw here, and that needs to be more refined and communicated in our publications and sessions developed to where we're leading to that. Because I'm from several different disciplines: medical anthropology, Native American studies, and I'm a four-field trained anthropologist. And when I sit in those sessions, a lot of them are talking theory. I don't see that here, but it could have been. It could have been if somebody was here challenging us and triggering that. We can talk that way too. And then we can affect the larger discipline. All right, thank you.
We are really running late. In fact, the session has concluded a few minutes ago. But I think if nobody comes in, we can stay here for a little bit longer. So, Terry, your mission is gone.
That's right, and yet, in case. So, we'll see.
How was that?
You have some questions and answers. Like, if you came in late for recording the session, if you do not want your voice, like your name, of course, you've already recorded it, put online, and turn off, and not use.
So I'm going to take a few minutes and ask if the I think you know where all the presenters are. So if you have a particular question for a presenter, why don't you go ahead and ask it? We'll start that way and take it from there. Yeah, sure.
I was wondering how you actually ask about the relationships. Because I know sometimes with these concepts, I was a big impacting member myself. Oh, I'm wondering, like, what other ways they talk about relationships. So sometimes that might be expressing care and concern, like, how well are these students doing, or how is everything going? And there could be lots of ways they're actually talking about the relationship. So I wondered if you mostly ask them about, you know, what's your idea about whether the relationship is strong or what attributes it has, or whether you ask them just like more openly, like what goes on here, and then you tease out the relationship piece. So I'm sorry, I'm talking over here. I can hear my neck is hurting. What do you think?
Well, I guess that's somewhat of the implied argument is that they're not asking these questions. But also, even in our in the interviews, we were asking more just the culture. So we were trying to understand what is obliquely the culture within mechanical engineering. But I think what we were finding over and over and over is that one thing that they were not talking about is relationships, building relationships. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a program that has an issue with graduate students not feeling connected with professors and being disconnected. And then also that was reiterated with the way staff were feeling. So one staff member actually said, you know, they're actually starting to call graduate students staff. And then she said staff, like, you know, she said it again, which meant like you were below professors and professors treated you a certain way. And they weren't, and maybe professors, as Dennis was mentioning, were overburdened, and it's not exactly a negative relationship, but they were overburdened with research. And they weren't aware of these relationships and what these impacts were having on staff and graduates. So I think some of that implied argument I was having is that they're not bringing any intentionality. And if you're not bringing intentionality, you're also not researching it. Right, you're not studying, you're not saying it's something that we should be concerned with on a very deep level. So, yeah, I think there needs to be a lot more research to be done. I mean, this is now the second year of a 5-year research program, so there's a lot more that needs to be done. Yeah,
yeah, it's interesting what they actually.
No,
it's not. I'm just curious.
Like,
what the heck do they talk about
there?
You know,
a lot of technical stuff. I mean, it's engineers. I mean, they talk about their work.
I can say one other thing too. I can't tell you how many times I have told the story of professor avoidance, and what that means is that, you know, the students are just not going to office hours. They are hopeful that the faculty member will recognize them, even though there are many large classes, particularly for the underclassmen. And we understand, we think, now why the avoidance is going on. But I would tell this to people at other universities, also in engineering schools, and they would just burst out laughing. So we know that it's a pattern, and we know it's, you know, we're getting that validation from other engineering programs. So there's something peculiar about it. It may be that it is broader than just engineering, but at any rate, we're pretty confident that it's associated certainly with engineering.
But the idea of office hours, though, you know, once again, the larger structure of the institution, we're required in my department and every department in the school to have regular office hours posted and in the syllabus. And it's standard behavior. Students don't come.
Yeah.
So it's academic culture. It's a larger system.
Yes. And so we actually have had a couple of the recourse sessions on that particular topic. And we are now thinking about alternatives to office hours. So, for example, in engineering, they have these places called tutorial rooms, where you usually staff them up with a TA, and the students will come there and work on their homework, and this is particularly for the underclassmen. And so if they get stuck, there's the TA. The TA hopefully will be able to help them. With one professor at one of the recourse sessions, he said, yeah, we have, you know, that's what the TA's job is, to answer the questions. And I said to him, well, have you ever sat in a tutorial room? He says, oh, yeah. He said, about 5 years ago I did, when my TA was sick. And I said, well, what was that experience like? And he said, it was fantastic. The students came and they asked questions. It's not like office hours. And so what we found was through just by getting him to think through it a little bit more, that there are alternatives to office hours that the students actually greatly appreciate. And that's not the only alternative, but that's one alternative.
And there are also some more creative, more modern things. Like, there's a whole concept, and someone in my department does it, they have walking office hours, and they go for a walk. I mean, there's lots of other ways. Like, an office hour doesn't have to be in somebody's office. Mm-hmm. You know, so that might be the first thing, is that you leave the office to have the office hour, you know, depending on what you're doing.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem with office hours, not to belabor it too much, but typically the individual working in his or her office is working, waiting for students to arrive. So if you're a young little sophomore, a brand new major in mechanical engineering, and you knock on the door and you see the professor working, what kind of a welcoming environment is that? Because you're afraid now that you're interrupting the professor, and you know the professor is so busy, even though you also know that it's office hours. So there are some issues there that need more exploration and alternatives proposed to help break down this distance barrier between faculty and students?
So I was an engineer before I turned from the dark side. I came into college, so I am so excited about y'all's research. I just can't explain it enough, and I think it's very, I can validate it at least from my experience, and it was outside of mechanical engineering. But I've also seen that now in practice, so I work with a large organization of engineers, and that pattern follows the pattern of subordinates talking to managers. It's still kind of the same behaviors. So I'm seeing the dealing with challenges of that in my own work. So my question is, because as an engineering student, my experience was I interacted more with faculty in other things outside of classroom. It wasn't in the associations or the professional organizations. So are y'all going to plan to share your findings with those types of organizations? Have you looked at how that interaction or those relationships are building outside of the traditional academic office hours or classrooms?
All right. Well, do you mean like the Formula One or Baja programs, or do you mean more the SAE or
SAE.
Okay, the Society for Automotive Engineers is one example of an organization that Joe is thinking about. And at this point, we don't have a plan to extend it directly to connections made at SAE or some of the other professional associations for engineering. However, we know that the students, many of the students, are directly connected to those organizations by being a member, for example, or on the Baja or one, Formula One teams. You know, they can spend time working on a vehicle that will end up being tested. And so they are active in a variety of organizations outside the classroom.
I think it's a really good idea that people follow in and see like how the thing reproduces itself when they get to the
mm-hmm.
next place.
Yeah.
Because if that's how their education structure and
right.
knowing also someone like what that looks like later on, they take that with them. And
right.
it's interesting.
Nothing you said really surprised me. I was like, yes, yes. Like, all of that stuff is true.
But I think that, I teach anthropology theory, and when I start off in all my classes, I said one of the human universals, you get two people together and three people together, there's always going to be a social distinction over time. It's a hindrance. And social stratification is a human universal. You know, it could be age, it could be gender. And so this is how it's being manifested in the mechanical engineering or each of the organizations. And so, you know, if it's universal, how do we get away from social stratification and the inequities that are the result is a real challenge.
Who else has a question for one of the panelists?
Well, Elizabeth, thank you for organizing.
Thank you all for coming.